Welcome to The Record here on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting this hour at KUOW. You may have heard the announcement aired live here on KUOW, just mentioned in our newscast. Less than 2 hours ago, Seattle Mayor Ed Murray, who denies accusations that he sexually abused four men when they were teenagers, has announced he is no longer running for re-election. He said he will finish his term, which ends in December. We have with us now Q13 News political analyst C.R. Douglas. Hi, C.R.
Good afternoon.
Why do you think Ed Murray dropped out of the re-election campaign?
Well, I think he saw the writing on the walls. It's pretty clear that poll numbers were showing that his support had plummeted quite a bit since these announcements of the allegations had surfaced about a month ago. And I'm told that polls even showed that in the head-to-head matchup with the contenders who are currently in the race, including Mike McGinn, he was likely to lose. So that was probably enough for him to say, hey, this just isn't worth it. It's not worth it to put my family through it, my husband, all the rest, if I might probably lose anyway by staying in.
If Murray is leaving because the scandal is hurting the city, as he said today, why not just leave office altogether?
Well, I think he feels that leaving the race will basically solve that problem. That is to say, it was going to be a huge distraction. It would have been something everyone talked about at every single political forum that these candidates were going to attend. And there's typically one, you know, every night and sometimes twice a day. So he was never going to get rid of this, and challengers were going to bring it up. I think he feels like he can still serve his term. He can still be productive in the last 8 or so months here. But that has yet to be seen. I mean, I don't rule out that in a couple months he feels like he can't even serve effectively as mayor. But I don't think yet we know that he can't. I think probably this is the relief council members and others who have to work with him needed, and will now be comfortable probably working with him when they might not have if he had still been in the race.
But he'll still be running a city while defending himself against sexual abuse allegations in this court case. Already today, mayoral candidate Carrie Moon said Murray should leave office. Quote, an aggressive legal fight where Mayor Murray feels compelled to use all the power of his position as a public official to demean and even silence his accusers is deeply divisive to our community and triggering for survivors of sexual assault. Mike McGinn also calling him to step down. What are your thoughts on the future of an embattled mayor staying in office?
Well, listen, he's damaged. It's not going to go away even in 8 months. But if you're the mayor and you are categorically denying these and saying it's false, I think it's in that situation a bad precedent to be saying you ought to leave office too. If he feels like this is something he wants to fight and it's not true, I think he's deserved his day in court. Is it a distraction? Will he be leading the city the same way if he didn't have this? Probably not. But listen, he was elected. He was elected to serve a four-year term. And, you know, if I was in this position and felt like these were unjust allegations, I wouldn't feel like I had to resign my position to fight them.
Talking with C.R. Douglas from Q13 News, let's talk about how this might affect the people of Seattle. The mayor, first of all, the mayor is now a lame duck, which must cost him leverage that he's been pretty good at using to get things done. Do you have any idea what an Ed Murray priority is that now is tenuous, something he might not be able to pass?
Well, probably the biggest thing out there is this new police contract. I mean, he is working now on a ton of accountability measures, and they are kind of working their way through the council. This would be the biggest change in policing probably ever in the history of Seattle. Huge new accountability measures, including a inspector general and a strengthened Office of Professional Accountability, Community Police Commission, all the rest. I mean, that's really probably his biggest priority between now and the end of the year. Whether that is harder because he's damaged, I don't know. As I was saying before, there may be a sense of relief from council members who, because he's not seeking re-election, are a little more willing to work with him on this than they might have otherwise. But let's just say any politician at the last 8 months of their term, in whatever kind of reason they're a lame duck, has more problems. It just comes with the territory. The final year is not as productive as the first year.
CR, what kind of new mayor do you think Seattle is likely to get? There are so many candidates.
There are a lot of candidates, and we're going to have a lot more. You know, you hear names like Jenny Durkin, the former U.S. attorney, even Bruce Harrell, the current city council president who has flirted with mayor before, actually run, might get in. Jessen Farrell, who's a representative up in northeast Seattle in the state legislature, has made quite a name for herself. I think a female candidate is going to be pretty attractive. You know, this city has only elected one female. It was back in 1928. I think because of the scandal and because of what's gone on, a female candidate in a lot of ways represents a real turning of the page and a fresh start. I'm not saying it's automatic, but I think a person like Jenny Durkin, who will get a lot of establishment support, a lot of people that would have gone Ed Murray's way will go her way. I think she's going to look pretty attractive.
What is Ed Murray's legacy?
Well, he has a long and really distinguished career in politics. I mean, if you go back to his early work in the legislature, there were big transportation packages. Of course, he's most known for all the gay rights work he championed and pushed down in Olympia, the civil rights bill, and then ultimately marriage equality. That's probably as big a legacy as most legislators ever get. But then if you add the work he's done in Seattle, it's really quite impressive. I mean, in just 3 years, really, he has accomplished more than a lot of mayors accomplish in two or three terms. I mean, there was that $15 minimum wage. There was family medical leave. He's pushed and passed a lot of levies at huge, huge price tags. I mean, that $1 billion transportation levy for Seattle streets and roads, that was enormous. A big bus measure to help save Metro. He'll be known for having pushed and helped with Sound Transit. This guy has quite a set of accomplishments. And though he won't have a second term, I think he could be pretty proud of what he's done up to now.
And of course, hanging over all of that are these accusations that he denies, that he says, accusations that paint me, I'm paraphrasing, paint me in the worst possible historic portrait of a gay man. He talked about having been gay, not having heard the word gay when he was young. I mean, he sort of framed this news conference around the issues of being gay in then and now.
Yeah, and it was an interesting point to make. You know, he's a devout Roman Catholic. And actually went to seminary for a while right out of high school. So he's well aware of that clergy scandal and the sexual abuse problems, of course, with the Catholic Church. He grew up in a time when gay men were not allowed to be out. So there was a bathhouse culture, an underground culture. I'm not saying Ed necessarily was involved in this, but that was sort of the time and place. And, you know, even these allegations that have come forward against him, there have been some in the gay community that said, you know, that was not that uncommon. The gay men back then were seeking sex partners in young, kind of homelessy, you know, in and out of drug problems sort of youth. So not saying this is true of Ed, but it was true of people in this generation. I think part of what was going to be ugly for him going forward also is, even if it's not true, he was about to be deposed. And depositions are by nature pretty wide-ranging and can get pretty ugly. So there would have been a lot of questions about sexual history, a lot of questions about, well, maybe, you know, what were you doing in the 80s? Who were you having sex with? What have you been doing more recently? Have you been unfaithful to your husband? How many sex partners have you had? I mean, all that kind of stuff, even if he was not guilty, was going to be pretty uncomfortable. I think anyone would not have to want to go to undergo that. That probably was going to all get out. That's not fun. So it was going to get uglier, not prettier, going forward for Ed Murray, even if the allegations aren't true. And I think that, combined with poll numbers, suggested this just isn't worth it.
Again, Seattle Mayor Ed Murray, who denies these accusations that he has sexually abused these men when they were teenagers, has announced he's not running for mayor anymore. He says he's going to finish out his term, which ends in December. We've been talking about it with Q13 News political analyst C.R. Douglas. Thank you so much, C.R.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Finally, a reaction from the attorney, a man who claimed that Murray sexually abused him in the 80s as a teenager, says that the mayor's decision to drop his reelection bid is a step toward justice and truth. That is according to Del Von Heckert's attorney, Lincoln Beauregard. More of KUOW's The Record just ahead. For 18 years, the band and orchestra at Kent Lake High School have taken a trip to perform in Victoria, British Columbia. Not this year. The Kent School Board canceled the trip because undocumented students could potentially be detained on their way back over the Canadian border. Some parents said this is just a political move that's punishing documented students who've been preparing for this trip and looking forward to it all year. One of those parents is Kent Lake's Tamara Stenman. Her 11th grade daughter was looking forward to that trip. Tamara, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
Tell us about this annual Victoria, BC band trip. Why is this such a big deal to you and your daughter?
This trip is very important to not only myself and my daughter, but for the school from generations past. This has been a 18-year tradition in which these students travel to Victoria, and they get quite the cultural experience.
How's that? What do they do in Victoria?
The band in itself does several performances throughout these 3 days. And the big highlight is the Victoria Days Festival parade, in which they really practice a lot, and they also create their own uniforms. As Kent School District does not have a lot of money, so what we have to do is these kids will create their own costumes for the theme in which we create each year that is different. One year it was for Ghostbusters, the next year it was for Thrift Shop, and the next year it was for Star Wars. So there's a lot of planning, costume preparation, money, time, and practice that these kids put into this.
And what do the kids get out of it?
What the kids get out of this is it's the cultural exchange. I believe firmly that this is part of what drives our musicians, and that to become something more, to be heard. And it gives them that little extra oomph that says, hey, somebody really likes my music.
What did you think when you found out your daughter will not be going on this trip to Victoria?
I was just beside myself. I felt the board did not give us consideration of early notice so that we could plan otherwise. Our students had paid for the trip, and for the board to cancel the trip on such short notice took us completely off guard. Our trip was 23 days away at that point. There was no time to be able to plan a trip if we wanted to do it ourselves outside of the Kent School District.
Well, the school board president says this decision was made because of a new race and equity policy that the school has been working on for years now. She sent us an email and said, we understand what a great tradition this Victoria trip has been for the majority of Kent Lake students, but how many students haven't been able to go there because of their documentation over the years? We can't ask students for their documentation status. We don't have any record of or awareness of documentation status. There have always been students and friends who have been left behind because of their documentation. In other words, it's an equity issue that undocumented kids don't feel like they can safely leave the country and make it back in, so they can't participate, and it's not fair. What do you say to that?
After I came to find out the same thing, the board said that they were afraid that we may leave with 100 students and only come back with 99. Mind you, crossing the border to Canada hasn't changed. Each student is required to have a passport or enhanced identity card or enhanced driver's license. This has been par for the course.
Well, the district is saying that even the risk leaves some of the band and orchestra members out of the trip, and that even though the border policy hasn't changed, it always had left some people out, and it's time to change that, even if they've left that in policy in place for years.
Well, they really haven't had any students that have felt left out, as far as what I know, and the fairness issue here, it needs to go both ways, as far as I'm concerned, and the other parents. That is our take on this.
You know, Tamara, not only might some kids not make a British Columbia trip if it happened this year, but they might feel like they're going to be outed as being undocumented. And there's a lot of uncertainty and fear about being undocumented these days with this new presidency. Do you think that's a part of the reason they want to just not go there when it comes to international travel?
I have thought about this, you know, and that is a good question. And that there may be a child, if there is a child that feels in that way, my heart goes out to them. And, you know, I feel very sorry for the circumstances that they're dealt with. With today's political climate, I can understand that. There, you know, what student is going to come to the school and say, hey, I'm undocumented, so I can't go, and I'm upset about this. And so it is a very, there's a fine line, yes, in between that. And I know many of these students and have known them for a long time. And I would have heard through the grapevine, oh, so-and-so wants to go, but they can't because of, you know, and I haven't heard anything about undocumented. So there is a possibility that could have happened in the past, but we have not heard of it yet.
Well, Tamara, it sounds like your daughter will not be making a band orchestra trip to British Columbia this year. So she knows that, and she's been watching this whole conversation and this debate and taking it all in. And what does your daughter say about all of this?
My daughter's reaction was that she went into tears, and she said, but we've practiced so hard and made all these costumes. Why are we being punished because someone might not be able to go? This isn't fair, Mom. There's always a few kids who don't want to go, or just because they can't go because they have to work or they have other commitments. And she said, but nobody has ever complained about not being able to go. Plus, we did the cookie dough fundraiser, Mom, so kids who can't afford to go can go. She said, Mom, this isn't right.
I've been talking with Tamara Stenman, who has a daughter in the Kent Lake Orchestra. Her daughter won't be going on that band trip to Victoria, B.C. The Kent School District has canceled that trip over the concerns we've talked about here of treating students equitably. Thank you, Tamara, for talking through this with us.
And thank you. You have a wonderful day.
And now let's hear from the Kent School District. Spokesman Chris Loftus joining us now live. Thank you, Chris.
I'm glad to be here.
What do you tell parents and students who say, as you just heard, Mom, this isn't right?
First of all, we 100% understand the disappointment that people are feeling, and 100% understand that they feel they've been treated unfairly. That's one of the reasons we've worked so hard to find an alternative to this trip. The band, the Kent Lake Band, will be going to the Lilac Festival in Spokane here in the next few days. So we've found an alternative. But that said, when you're working all year to get ready for a trip to one place, and in the last few weeks you find out you're going somewhere else, understandable disappointment. I was in the band myself many, many decades ago, and so I know how much those trips mean. I know how much you learn. I know how much how enriching they are. So we understand that. But, and unfortunately, there's always a but in these discussions. And we have a commitment to equity. There's state and federal law that doesn't allow us to identify or to offer any sort of differing educational platform or service to students, regardless of their legal, their documentation status, regardless of disability, regardless of ethnicity. I mean, we have a mandate to be the front line of democracy. We have to be free and fair and equitable to every student. And when we started looking at this, I had a parent with the same passions and the same eloquence that Ms. Stenman just exhibited, who came in and said, Christian, I can guarantee you, I've been chaperoning this trip for years, I can guarantee you there's not been an undocumented student on this trip. And therein lies the problem. If you can guarantee me that one subgroup of the students that we serve are not able to participate in an activity, we can't have that activity. It's a matter of equity. It's a matter of fairness.
As you said, Chris, the school district does not identify which students are undocumented. Have you heard anecdotally that students have affirmatively skipped the Victoria trip because of their status?
Anecdotally, yes. But again, we aren't allowed by law to inquire or to take records. And so I can't tell you how many students have documentation status, challenged documentation status in our district. We just don't know. But we're a large district with almost 28,000 students. We're one of the most diverse districts in the country. I think we had one ranking service list us as the 11th most diverse district in the entire United States just a couple of months ago. We have over 135 languages spoken in our district, kids coming from over 100 countries. So we have to recognize that we have a population of folks who this affects.
That Kent Lake parent asked, why should all students in the band and orchestra lose out on an experience because of the status of just one or two students? She says, if we're talking fairness, it's got to go both ways. What do you say to parents who tell you that?
Well, I hear that on a situational level, and I'm a parent and a former band member myself, so I understand the situation. I understand the passions. But I if we were going on a trip somewhere, or if we had a school-sanctioned trip and we found out that students who were of a certain ethnicity weren't going to be welcomed in that town, that community, or be able to cross a border, or for whatever reason, weren't going to be able to participate, we wouldn't go. We'd stand up, and we'd say, no, that's not who we are as a country. That's not who we are as an organization. That's not who we are as individuals. If we had a disabled student, a situation where there was a trip and a disabled student was barred from participation or going for whatever reason, we wouldn't go because we'd stand up for that one disabled student.
Well, Chris, as you know, some parents say that's a poor comparison because ethnicity and medical disability, they're not a choice, but being undocumented was a choice made by that student's parents, if not the student.
Exactly. That's a choice made by someone else for the most part for these students. Our students come to us. And again, we're not able to. It's not like they walk in the door and we put a list on their badge about their status or about their ethnicity or about their disability or about their cognitive skills or about. We serve every student. We have a moral and legal responsibility to serve every student equally and equitably. We leave all that other stuff to other argumentation to other discussion. We serve every student. And so regardless of what their parents may or might have done, might not have done, regardless of political party affiliation, regardless of who's in the White House or what the current debate is, we serve every student, and we have to do so equitably. And so this was a very difficult decision because we knew that it had an impact on a wonderful tradition of going to on this trip.
Chris,
but it was one that the board decided to make.
We're talking with the spokesman for the Kent School District, Chris Loftus. Chris, some parents say this is a political move. Is the Kent School District making a statement opposing President Trump's rhetoric on immigration and border security or his policies?
No. The Kent School District is making a statement for equity. The Kent School District is making a statement for fairness. The Kent School District is predicated on three core values: equity, excellence, and community. And when we looked at our practice in this regard, we recognized that we were out of compliance with one of our core values, and the Kent School District is rectifying that.
Finally, Chris, one last question. We have a minute left. What do you want to leave parents and kids with who are feeling, whether they agree with you or not, they're feeling disappointed, maybe they're feeling upset? What do you want to say?
I want to say we understand that you're upset. We understand that you're disappointed. We feel that too. This was not an easy. If you were at that board meeting 2 weeks ago, there were tears in every board member's eye as they cast their vote. But it was a unanimous vote because it was a vote on equity. It was a vote on fairness. It was on something that was bigger than the situation. It was something about the system, about the country we live in, the system and the fairness and the compassion that we feel for every student. And I know that at this point, those who are negatively impacted by this on this situation don't feel that compassion. But I think with reflection, years down the line, I think people will be prouder that they were part of a system that treated everyone with fairness and dignity and respect than they would. That'll be a fonder feeling than a memory of a single trip.
Chris Loftus, spokesperson for the Kent School District, where the school board has canceled the high school's annual band and orchestra trip to Victoria, British Columbia, over concerns that undocumented students might not be allowed back. So instead of British Columbia, it's on to Lilac Fest in Spokane. Chris, thanks for talking with us.
Glad to help. Thank you.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. We're live tweeting at KUOW, so if you're hearing things that you want to comment on during the show, please do, at KUOW. Wildfires that are bigger than 100,000 acres get a special name, megafires. They are a growing threat across the American West, which is why one federal scientist in the Northwest is hitting the road with his research, as correspondent Emily Schwing reports.
Hundreds of foresters, loggers, and other timber industry players were in Coeur d'Alene for a meeting of the Idaho Forest Group last month. That's where they heard from Paul Hesberg.
I've been in the woods around where I live, and I'm watching the fires chew up an awful lot of forest, and it doesn't look or work the same as it did 50 years ago.
Hesberg has worked for the U.S. Forest Service as a research ecologist in central Washington for more than 30 years.
We've learned that in the historical forest, every place that could grow trees didn't grow trees.
His research shows decades of fire suppression and misunderstandings about ecological function, combined with a lack of land management funding, means forests are overgrown and the landscapes ripe for large, hot, and fast-moving fires.
Hello, I'm Smokey Bear.
When he was a kid, the agency Hesberg works for was relentless with one message.
Remember, only you can prevent forest fires. Only you.
But he says Smokey Bear's message needs a tune-up.
Smokey can't say it in one sentence anymore. He's got a longer message. Prevent forest fires, but allow us to make the right kind of fires so the wildfires are more benign.
To make his point, he employed the help of documentary filmmaker and Wenatchee native Jeff Austinson.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up here. I remember playing high school football, and during a Friday night football game, Friday Night Lights, looking up on the hillside above town, and it's on fire.
Austinson's production company, North 40 Productions, helped turn Hesberg's research into a multimedia presentation known as Era of Megafires.
This is an example of the epidemic of trees that has occurred throughout the western United States, especially in mixed conifer forests.
There are side-by-side comparisons of past and current photos, and there are also infographics and animations. The team has delivered the presentation in 30 cities in the West. There are at least as many more on this summer's calendar.
We're basically going to go out and do little vignettes. We're going to meet some people, understand their perspective on this, and then maybe we meet some scientists on the way. And throughout, we have Paul as our guide.
You know, everywhere you look in this patch of forest, you can see all the rules of a frequent fire regime are broken.
According to Hesberg, megafires are completely preventable. That struck a nerve with Jeff Austinson, who watched a wildland fire destroy 29 homes in Wenatchee in 2015.
I've seen how devastating it can be. I think recently we've seen more devastation, and I don't want to see that again. I just flat out, no, it's not part of the future that I want to be a part of. So if I'm a part of that or can do something to make that happen, then yeah, it'd probably be the most significant thing I've done professionally.
All right, I want you to close your eyes just one time again, and I want you to recall that forest that you pictured yourself in.
With help from Austinson's team, Hesberg will deliver a condensed version of Era of Megafires as a TED Talk in Bend in mid-May.
Do you think about it in the same way now? Thanks for playing along.
I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. You've heard about Seattle's anti-Trump stand as a sanctuary city. It's a debate in this region. It's a debate across the country. Well, a couple of podcast producers wanted to understand where the idea of sanctuary came from in the first place. Roman Mars is creator of the podcast 99% Invisible. Helen Zaltzman is creator of the language podcast The Illusionist. And separately, they delved into the history of sanctuary. They found that religion played a big role in both the meaning of the word and the movement that started in the 80s as Central American migrants came to the United States. Roman Mars told me about a man named Jim Corbett, a Quaker who was a key figure in the U.S. sanctuary movement.
And, you know, he likened the refugee crisis in the 80s to slavery, and where the Quakers were really pivotal as a faith in the Underground Railroad. And he thought that this was part of the continuum of what they were doing back then, and that it really was related to the work that was happening today, that it had been shown that the Quakers of the time and during slavery times were shown to be doing the right thing. And so he thought that this was all part of that same movement and should be continued to this day. And I think that we, you know, wanted to focus on this period of history to show that there were a lot of similar issues that were happening in the 80s, but a little bit of the characters had changed. You know, we wanted to show that there was the different players had different alliances during the sanctuary movement back in the 80s, and just sort of think about what that meant today and not really show any sort of prescriptive solution for it all, but just to show the echoes and try to sort of pull that to today and see what you think about it when you hear the story of sanctuary churches. And are you, hooray, they saved people? Or are you, well, they were not adhering to the law of immigration? And so they're just, I like to raise those questions and not really provide the answers necessarily.
Helen, you took a long view of the big history of the concept of sanctuary, and it might surprise some people.
Yes, so I was visiting the 99% offices a few weeks before their sanctuary episodes came out, and they mentioned they were working them. And I thought, oh, it's interesting that that word has this sacred element in its history, but what did that come from? And so I looked into it, and for about 1,000 years in Britain, till I think the 17th century, the rule was that basically if you committed a crime, you could go to a church and hide there for up to 40 days, depending on where it was. So basically, you could escape justice. That's what the sanctuary meant. Because the laws in Britain were so bananas, whereby if you had murdered somebody, then you just had to arrange with their family to pay them some money. But if you'd stolen something, that was punishable by death. So you would go into sanctuary to avoid being punished by death. And there were different levels of sanctuary as well. So there were some sanctuary counties, but if you committed the crime when you were already in a sanctuary county, you needed to get to a sanctuary town. And if you committed a crime there, you needed to get to a sanctuary church, but preferably one of the big cathedrals. And because you were safer in those and you got a better level of sanctuary. So if you got a really good cathedral, your food and clothes would be supplied for that period of time. Otherwise, your family had to come to the church where you were just sleeping on the stone floor and bring you food. And if they did that after your days of sanctuary were up, they were liable to the death penalty. So that was what smote you out of your sanctuary. And then in the cathedral, there was often a shrine or a chair that was the ultimate sanctuary. So if someone came into the cathedral breaking your sanctuary in order to mete out justice upon you, and if they grabbed you and killed you, they were just subject to a fine. But if you managed to get to this special chair in the cathedral and sit on it and they still killed you, then they were liable to death. So it was just this extraordinary mess of brutal English history that I found. But I also found it so intriguing that a religious place would kind of condone criminal activity, except I think to them it was the idea of allowing people time to repent or a pressure valve to be released so that the people seeking vengeance might not bother anymore. Or you might think you've killed someone and actually they're fine, but it took a while to find out. So there are all these things at play. And then some people lied about having murdered someone just because they needed to get out of their marriages and divorce wasn't an option at the time.
What was the religious understanding at that time of why that sanctuary system was the Christian thing to do?
I think because it was the idea that you could repent. It was unusual that Britain was so lenient compared to other places that did do it, but I think it was just the religious response to the fact that our laws were so very punitive then. They were so extreme that you could steal something and pay with your life. So that I think they were just trying to counterbalance that a bit.
Roman, how did religion play into the early American sanctuary movement? Because your piece tells us about how those Christians were claiming that this was a kind of worship that they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, this was part of their sort of interpretation of their faith and charity, and it totally made sense to them that they would shelter people who were being persecuted in other countries, and that if the church had the means to protect them, that they would. And it was, you know, it required some convincing. You know, Jim Corbett was an active Quaker, and he had to really talk to Reverend Fife in our story to sort of make it happen. They at first began to bring people over, and a lot of them were staying in private homes. And then when the number of refugees got so much, then they made the case for them being housed in the church itself, which, you know, created a greater risk for the church community. But they all decided to, to bear that risk together.
Did your reporting, your team's reporting, change how you think about today's sanctuary city debate?
I love the idea of the church being a radical actor in this way for progressive causes that I happen to support, you know, personally. And so it was just nice. It was a nice story to hear and to tell, and to have Delaney report back and hear these people that really believe in what they're doing, and recognize that this is going to come up again. And the sanctuary movements and sanctuary cities today, how the government reacts to them is going to be interesting to find out, because right now the main stick to stop sanctuary cities from doing what they're doing is, you know, the spending clause of the Constitution, and how they use that to withhold money when a city isn't, you know, behaving in the way that the federal government wants it to. And that's a whole nother fight that is not really related to exactly to churches and sensitive areas, but it's still like we have to figure out what our values are and how the federal government can use its power, and how much we're willing to accept the federal government using its power. And in the case of the sanctuary movement of the 80s, it was really real legal proceedings of what they viewed as breaking the law. And in the future, it's going to be actions from the executive of trying to, and of Congress actually, limiting what they allow spending to happen in cities and through grants, because they don't agree with the policies that they sort of instate for undocumented immigrants. And so, you know, it's a really good time to like really examine our values and what we want to do and what we want to be as a country. And I think this lesson from history just gives you some kind of clarity, whether or not you agree with it or not. I think it just, you know, maybe telling the story in this way slightly, you know, changes it, so you can take it out of the context of the present day and see where you land with it, and see who you support, see, you know, what you care about. And that's why I like to tell that story through the lens of the past. It cools it down a little bit and allows people to just hear it as a story, and then, you know, maybe take from it something from today, or maybe just enjoy it as a story in and of itself of really remarkable people standing up for what they believe in.
Helen, do you view today's sanctuary city debate in Seattle and elsewhere any differently, having delved into the history of sanctuary?
I think the present day situation was certainly resonating for me when I looked into the history. But my intent with my show is it's generally quite lighthearted, and it's trying to cheer people up on a bad day or a terrible commute or something. So I don't necessarily find it that easy to deal with serious issues. But I think what happened was people heard the episode with all this strange medieval history in it, and they made the connections with the present and with the 99% Invisible episodes. And so they could see this big continuum in how humans behave to each other, and the role that religious institutions make, and how the law is not this absolute thing, and how religious interaction with that law is not an absolute thing either.
Helen Zaltzman is host and creator of the language podcast, The Illusionist. That starts with the letter A, The Illusionist. And Roman Mars is creator and host of 99% Invisible, a show about the unnoticed architecture and design that shape your world. We are tweeting out a link to help you find their episodes about Sanctuary. So join us on Twitter at KUOW. And you can see Roman Mars and Helen Zaltzman do live episodes of their podcasts tonight, along with the podcasts Mortified, The Memory Palace, and Criminal. Helen says it's going to be a night off from the loneliness that comes with making a podcast by yourself at home. They are out in public. More theater tonight, 8 o'clock. KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke, and I have news. The Mariners have won their last two games. Two games. That's news when you're having a losing season, as the Mariners are doing yet again. You do have an undefeated pro team in Seattle right now. They're 5-0, and they could win the whole thing. Here are two of the players.
My name is Alicia Edlin, and I play defensive end and fullback.
Mackenzie Tolliver, and I play safety, receiver, and punt return.
You just had to put that in there.
Always. It's my favorite.
Alicia and Mackenzie play on the Seattle Majestics, our women's tackle football team, and they told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel what it's like to play football in a place where they're overshadowed by one, sometimes two, other football teams.
You have the ears of tens of thousands of people when this airs who have probably never heard of the Seattle Majestics.
Okay.
What do you want them to know?
We're awesome.
Jinx! What do we want them to know? We look like a men's tackle football team. Obviously, there's some technical things and speed of play is a little different. But like, if you look at the line, it's a line. So it's really cool to watch because you feel like you're watching football just like you are anywhere else. So, you know, we put our helmets on and you can't totally tell that we're a female sports team, which to me as an athlete, I take a lot of pride in.
How do you know that men don't expect you to know that much about football?
You can tell when you have conversations. They do. And some men get offended when you talk to them and you're like, well, you know, if you run this play or we do this because they're like, well, of course I know that. You know, they're like kind of intimidated by, I think, women's football intelligence sometimes. But you can tell by the way they ask. Not all of them. So no disrespect because we have some great coaches that,
oh, yeah, definitely,
that talk to us like we already know. You know, they're very respectful, but there are some that they're very skeptical about what we really know about football. And I would say it isn't until they come see us play. The skeptics become unskeptical when they come see us play and they see it all put together. And then you have conversations with them and they're like, oh, okay.
When you get to tell people now that you play tackle football, when you tell other people,
mm-hmm,
I play for the Majestics, what kind of response do you get?
I laugh because the first response I get is that most people don't know that there's women's tackle football outside of the LFL. So I get a lot of questions about that. And then I have to tell people that, no, we play 11 on 11, full tackle. We're fully geared up, fully suited.
Somebody tell me what LFL stands for.
Well, it's Legends Football League.
Yes.
But it's the Lingerie Football League.
Okay.
Yeah, the Seattle Mist.
I'm sorry, I have to ask this question. How often is it that you tell somebody you play football and they assume that you're a member of the Mist, that you play lingerie football?
Probably about 4 to 5 times.
And it takes them a minute to process. I mean, because, and, you know, all due respect, they've given themselves a name around here. You know, people go to their games and people know who they are. So either people have been to their games or, you know, there was some a series on TV and stuff like that. So it takes them a minute to just fully process, like, whoa, this is like the down and dirty. This is real, like, full pads, 11v11, mm-hmm, you know, full field football. So it takes them a minute to process and, like, shift their mindset to the different dynamic that our football brings versus the Lingerie League.
So, Mackenzie, when you have that conversation, it sounds like you're both fairly well-versed in having this conversation.
Yes.
When you have this conversation and someone responds with the assumption that you play for the Mist, mm-hmm, and not for the Majestics, how do you walk them through what happens?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've gotten so good at it now. My first few wasn't so easy, but they don't come straight out and ask. I mean, I think the word lingerie makes people uncomfortable. For me personally, people kind of look at me and you can tell in their mind, they're like, Okay, so you lingerie. Like they're looking at you thinking lingerie football league, right? So I just say, and just to clarify, there are two different leagues, and I just explain the leagues through to them and explain, you know, everything that goes along with our league versus the lingerie league.
Alicia, is that how you handle it?
Mackenzie is a little more feminine than I am. So I kind of just crack a joke. I'm like, do you really think that I'm going to run around half naked looking like this? So. But honestly, I just basically say, no, we play 11 on 11 tackle football, and generally I'll show them a highlight video that we have.
Or, yeah, and that helps too is in explaining to people, I'll pull up a picture of, you know, either the team or myself in full pads right away, so that not only have I explained it, I'm like, no, like this is legit. You know, this is full pads. Because then you'll say full pads, but they're still like, like full pads? Like, yes, like helmet, shoulder pads, leg pads, everything. Yeah. So sometimes just creating a visual form really seals the deal.
I have to ask, I mean, I know that you both work full time. Scheduling you both to come in wasn't easy because you work. Mackenzie, you have kids. This is not an issue for the Seahawks. Playing is their full time jobs. I mean, what is it like to play for a team while seeing another team that everybody else here seems to love and care about, knowing that they get to make a living doing that?
I'm just at a position where it's just reality right now. So I try not to let it discourage you. And rather, I'm in a position of trying to improve the sport and empower females to play. We may not see that happen in our generation of football, but yeah. It motivates me to get other players to have that opportunity. Because how cool would it be to literally play football for a living, whether you're male or female?
I mean, it can be frustrating that women's sports isn't at the same level as men's sports. And like Mackenzie said, it is the reality of things, but we're in a position to where we can change that. There's leagues coming up that are all female young girls playing tackle football. Those are the ones who are going to be the ones who see the change that we're trying to make in the football community, that men just don't play football. Women do too. And we can hit, we can run the ball, we can catch, we can do everything that the guys can do.
Alicia and Mackenzie, I talked with one of your teammates, Adrian Wilson. She said that she remembered when she first started playing for the Majestics. So she's been on the team for more than a decade.
Yeah, she's the granddaddy.
Yeah, yeah. Granddaddy Majestic.
She remembers practicing on elementary school baseball fields. That was one of the things she told me. Mm-hmm. And now the team practices on turf. The team plays on turf. And she said that was, for her, a real marker of progress in football for women. She could see that as a huge leap forward, right? So I'm wondering how each of you have seen the sport progress since each of you have started playing. Mackenzie, what about you? You've been on the team for 3 years now.
I mean, it's come a long ways. I mean, again, not on just my 3 years, but from my knowledge of before, is like, that's an example of like not playing on turf fields. The fact that we have, how many teams do we have in the WFA?
60.
Yeah, definitely over 50. And it's more and more prominent. There's young girls that are playing in high school. We actually have a girl in the league who is in high school, and she's playing quarterback in our league. So it's super cool. Like, she's playing for her high school and she's playing in our league. So that would probably be the one testament of progress, is having, you know, young girls who are playing football at the next level for women already. Like, she's already setting herself up. So, I mean, we've come a long ways. We have a long ways to go still, but the fact that we're not, you know, driving up, playing on grass fields, shining our lights on the fields, you know, from our cars, just to be able to play longer is huge.
Alicia, how have you seen the sport progress since you've played over the last 6 years?
One of the main things is our games are starting to be broadcasted now. I mean, not on major stations, but internet shows. Like, we stream on Facebook Live to get our games out there. There are still teams who practice on grass fields, so it's still in progress. There weren't any leagues for young girls to play in when I first started playing. That's awesome to me, just the fact that there's enough girls who want to play football that they have their own leagues now, not just at an adult level, but at a 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old level.
We were down in Orlando for Women's World Games in January. It may have been one of the coolest moments of my life seeing female sports progress. Is there was a flag tournament, like a national flag tournament for all ages.
Like flag football?
Yeah, flag football. starting at like 8 and going all the way up to 18. And there was full girls teams starting at 8 or 9 years old up until 18. And it was super cool to watch them play. These girls, they're spending their time playing flag football, which is the next step, you know, is having full teams in full tournaments around the country. And at a national level, I mean, that's a national level tournament for them. So that was a really clarifying moment for me that we're definitely making progress.
So if you had to look 20 years down the road, what do you think women's football is going to look like?
I think about this all the time. Without what I want and what I think, I have to separate those two things.
What do you want? Let's start there.
Yeah, what I want is I want full women's tackle football leagues, just like hockey progressed. There's full hockey leagues. Those women go to college and play football in college on full ride scholarships. That's what I want, is that football to be a sport that not even less concerned about the professional level, but through the college level. Because to me, as cool as it is to play like through club and do all these things, college is such a huge thing for so many kids that miss opportunities. And so if we can get it into the universities and have full scholarships for these kids, to me, that's clutch. Because then after that, then you have, you know, a huge pool of talent to really push the sport and get spectators and all of that. But that's what I would like to see is for it to get into the universities the way that women's hockey did. In 20 years, I think that could be realistic.
Honestly, one of the biggest things is, like, I'm hoping, you know, in 20 years that we do have it down to one league that everybody plays in. Because right now we have 2 or 3 different leagues and it divides us. I think at some point we all need to come together and see the bigger picture that we all want the same thing. So we need to create one league to where we can achieve it, not 3 different leagues trying to fight to, you know, be the top league.
Football as a sport draws a very broad demographic. And overall, in general, it's not as expensive over the years to play. That's why you see so many different types of people play. And I think is what we're missing is that we have that opportunity for men or young boys, but we're missing that for women is the female athletes, that there really isn't a sport for them, whether it's too expensive, it's just not available, or their athletic type just can't mold into a certain sport. And so for me, I want to see the sport progress because I feel like we can capture so many young girls and change their lives.
That was Alicia Edlin and Mackenzie Tolliver from the Seattle Majestics. The team plays at French Field in Kent, and their next home game is on the 27th of May. You can watch some game video. You can get tickets, too, at the Majestics website. So we'll tweet out a link to that for you right now, at KUOW. I'm glad you joined us on the record today. Coming up this afternoon, reports of anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. are up 86% this year, by one account. With that increase comes a new wave of interest in an old German law that reinstates German citizenship to Holocaust refugees and their descendants. You'll hear why people are making the decision to get that dual citizenship coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Thanks for tuning in.